We'll call this committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum present. And first off, I just want to thank Calista Mons for putting this thing together for us today. And thank all the staff for getting it set up. Thank you all for coming. We really appreciate you being here. We're here because we want to know what your concerns are. And not only your concerns, but... Sorry about that. All right, we'll try one more time. Thank you all for coming, and you know, we really want to hear your concerns. Not only concerns, and we know a lot of what the issues are, but any type of ideas you might have, solutions you might have, and that's kind of where we're here today, is to see if we can get more information. And again, I just thank you for coming. We have a really good crowd tonight. It's really, appreciate all of our fellow representatives making it down here to Faribault today, so I appreciate you guys coming. And and our staff members, I forgot, Kaylee and Holly and David, all you guys, thank you so much for coming down and helping out today. And so we'll do is first we're going to hear the presentation by the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and then we'll open up to public testimony. If you'd like to testify and you haven't signed your name on the agenda there, please sign up for that. We have quite a few people that do want to testify today, so if we could maybe hold your comments to about 3 to 5 minutes would be good so we can get through on time and get to hear as many as we can. And with that, we'll start the presentation, I guess, for Minnesota. Yeah. During the overview of the nursing facilities in Minnesota, there'll be a lot of questions regarding quality. We invite the Minnesota Department of Human Services to come back and discuss issues relating to the quality as well as the 2012 Long-Term Service and Support Nursing Facilities Report. The report should be in your folder. And again, welcome to the committee. And if you please, when the testifiers come up, please state your name for the record.
It's a long time since I used a Fender amplifier.
Last Friday night.
No, it's closer to half a century, I think. So I'm Bob Hild from the Department of Human Services, the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. I presented about 3 weeks ago for this committee. And I didn't get feedback then, but I'm gonna cover two documents with you. One is the nursing home report card, which you see on the screen here to my right. And the other is the status of long-term services and supports for nursing facilities, a legislative report. In both of these, we have a couple data sources that we use. One is an annual statistical and cost report filed by every nursing home in the Medicaid program with the Department of Human Services. And the other is, it feels so loud. Okay. I'll do it this way.
So, in the back, can everybody hear him okay in the back? Okay, good, thank you.
Okay, so the other data source is what we, an assessment form. I think if we turn the volume down just a tad, it might get less feedback, but is a form called the MDS, the Minimum Data Set, and it's an assessment of every nursing home resident that's mandated by the federal government to be conducted annually and updated quarterly, at least, and then submitted electronically to the federal government, and the federal government then shares that with us. and we use that to compile some of this information as well. So Stacy's going to operate the report card for us. This is live on the internet, and you'll find the website on the top. I think it's www.dhs.mn.gov. And you can also just Google Minnesota Nursing Home Report Card, and this will be the first thing that comes up. At least it always has been when I've done that. So what you see here on the screen right now is the welcome page to the report card. It tells a little bit about how it's used, and if you'll scroll to the bottom of that, because we won't read through the entire welcome, that gray box at the bottom is a button. You push that, and it brings you to the search page of the report card. And let's see, we're in Faribault. So Stacy, would you enter Faribault for us? And we're going to search for nursing homes in this area. And above that, she's going to say, we want to find all the nursing homes within 10 miles of Faribault. And so now click the button where it says click, and just hit OK. And it allows us to select quality measures that are important to the user. And I'm going to skip that because we haven't talked yet about the quality measures, so I don't want to get that out of sequence for our conversation. So it looks like there are three nursing homes within 10 miles of Faribault. Anybody know of any fourth ones? We've got Faribault Care Center, Pleasant Manor, and St. Lucas Care Center. Okay, and you'll see along the top of that the name of the facility and the city that it's located in. They're all in Faribault. And then there's seven quality measures listed. The first one is resident quality of life, and I'll tell you a little bit about these as we walk through them. The resident quality of life has to do with an interview that's conducted with nursing home residents in all facilities in the state that are in the Medicaid program. So this coming year, we will have interviewers go into all 367 of those facilities and conduct face-to-face interviews with almost 13,000 individuals. And the purpose of that is to hear their voice, to let residents tell us themselves how they feel about their own quality of life and the satisfaction that they experience with the care that they're receiving. So on quality of life, you can see we've got a one-star facility, a three-star facility, and a four-star facility. And then I'm going to ask Stacy if she would click on that button there that has a star, an arrow, and a number. And when she clicks on that, it's going to leave the stars on the screen, but it's also going to show us the actual numerical values so that you can see if somebody's a three-star but really close to a four-star or really close to a two-star. If you're interested in that level of detail, if the user really just wants the simplest way of looking at this, we can click on that again, and it'll go back to showing just the stars. So quality of life asks about comfort and dignity and relationships and mood. There's about 12 domains that are covered, and we'll be able to drill down and see that a little bit more too. The next one is the Minnesota Quality Indicators. And those are based on that MDS form that I mentioned. And what you find is that if a facility has a higher prevalence than expected of a certain kind of a condition that's not a good condition to have, like decubitus ulcers or falls, then you're going to lose stars. And if you have a higher prevalence of a condition that's good to have, like improving independence with ambulation or daily functioning, then you'd have more stars showing up on there, and we'll be able to drill down into that shortly as well. Hours of direct care tells us comparatively with other facilities how much staff the facility has. It's adjusted for case mix. You would expect to see more staff in a facility that has higher acuity. So it's adjusted for that. It's also adjusted in a way that kind of equalizes RNs, LPNs, and nursing assistants, so that we wouldn't create an incentive to get rid of all the RNs and just have cheaper nursing assistants in order to get more stars. It adjusts for that as well. Staff retention tells us from the beginning of the reporting year on that cost report that I mentioned until the last day of the reporting period for direct care staff, how many were there the first day and what portion of them are still there the last day. So that's retention of direct care staff. Temp agency use. About 3/4 of facilities in the state do not use any temp staff. When we created the report card, the use of temp staff was a lot more prevalent and was a real quality concern, but we felt like we should leave it on there just so that where the findings are different, it would still show up. Proportion of beds in single bedrooms. Minnesota, we believe, probably has the highest percentage of all of its beds in single bedrooms. I think the privacy that that provides is a real value. About 47 to 49% of our beds now are in single bed or private rooms. And then the final measure on the far right is state inspection results. And that takes the certification survey that the health department does and looks at different degrees of harm that result from the care that's being provided. And if that's a real low level of harm, probably none, you'll have 5 stars, and that can go all the way down to 1 star. So let's pick one of those facilities. Does anybody have a preference for which facility we should use? Any of the members have a preference? Representative Lilly, I think, does. No? Oh, I was thinking you looked like you had a preference. Maybe Representative Daniels, do you want me to, or should we just take, let's take St. Lucas.
That was going to be my suggestion, same.
All right, side. We're on the same wavelength. So Stacy's going to click the name of the facility, and now we're going to see a history of their star ratings over the last year and a half or so. So you can see, for example, on quality of life, which is only done annually, but those data points are about every third or fourth of a year. So you'll have several quality of life that are going to be the same sequentially. They actually went from 3 stars to 4 stars, and the green on the top is the statewide average. And again, if she clicks on the star number button, then we will be able to see the actual data there. And so you can see that the most recent quality of life score was 84 out of 100, and the statewide average is 82.7. Those are very compressed, by the way. On the clinical quality indicators, you can also, again, see that they're scoring above state average, 4 stars, and you can see the history of that.
Mr. Allen?
Yes.
Could you enlarge the screen a little bit so some of the other people back here might be able to see a little better? Is that possible? If it works, if it doesn't.
It worked.
There we go.
All right.
Thank you.
So if it gets much bigger, it probably won't show all of it, and that will be a problem, but let's maybe give that a try. Okay. So we're going to scroll down a little bit, and there's going to be a gray box under quality of life, and Stacy's going to click that for us, and then scroll down. And what you can see now is a whole bunch more detail about each of those 12 domains of quality of life. So, for example, it starts with overall percent positive, and it gives you the facility score, which we saw before, and the state average, which we saw before. But now you can also see that this facility ranks, 107th out of 374 facilities. 107th, so that's pretty good. But it also tells them how they rank on each of those domains compared to the rest of the state and compared to how they're doing on other domains. So if you're the administrator or the director of nursing of this facility, you might look and notice Dignity, we rank 303rd out of 374. Is that something we want to work on? So what this report card does is it gives a facility a great deal of information for benchmarking. They don't have to go on hunch and intuition to sense whether their quality is doing well or doing poorly and how their residents are feeling about it. And they don't have to design their own survey. They've got a good survey here that's been scientifically vetted and that is being used in exactly the same way across the state. And so that gives them a really good basis statistically for comparing how they're doing and deciding if there's some areas where they need to focus some quality improvement effort. Let's scroll up a little bit and now click the other gray box, and this will give us a much bigger table of drill down information on the quality indicators. Those are the only two drill downs I'm going to subject you to. And this gives, I believe it's 24 quality, very specific quality indicators. And the top group are the ones where it's better to have a low score. So it's things like prevalence of physical restraints. This facility had zero. The statewide average is 0.8%. So how could they have zero and rank 129th? I was hoping nobody would ask me that question. So this is a function of the risk adjustments and the size of the facility. And there's some statistical activity going on behind the scene that would result in something like that. So you once again, you get all of that drill down data. And this is really useful for a consumer, in addition to the facility uses that I described earlier, to be able to look at this and say, you know, I don't really care much about some of these measures because they're not relevant for my loved one that I'm thinking about placing in a nursing home. But this issue about, I don't know, unexplained weight loss, so my loved one has a tendency to lose weight and not eat very well, and this is a facility that's doing really well on that or really poorly on that. That could have to do with falls. You might be really concerned about falls risk and want a facility that really can manage that well. So what's the point of the report card? It's to measure how people are doing. It's to notify or share that data with the facility so that they can benchmark and they can focus quality improvement. It's for allowing prospective residents and their loved ones to look at the report card and see if use that to inform a decision about which facility to make a placement in. And it's for current residents and their loved ones, their caregivers, to look at it and say, you know, we're having a problem with this area. And by the way, I checked the report card and I noticed you're not doing so well in that area. Or, you know, I've got a concern and I noticed that you're doing really well. I guess maybe you're doing as well as we can expect. So it helps. I think it helps. It's designed and intended to help people really understand the care in a specific facility and how that's working out. Are there any questions on the report card?
Looks like there's none, so you can continue, Mr. Helm.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the 2012 Long-Term Care Services and Supports Nursing Facilities. This is a report to the legislature. By statute, the Department of Human Services, and I believe Health works with us on this, are both required to deliver this report to the legislature once every other year. We're due to submit this again on August of 2015. And it's the same kind of data sources I talked about earlier. This is a report that my division has been producing for at least 20 years now. And initially the purpose of the report had to do with the moratorium. So Minnesota has a moratorium that says we have more than enough beds, and you'll see some data in here about that. And we're going to put an absolute moratorium. No beds can be added in Minnesota except if the legislature enacts a law that says, okay, we're going to let you add some beds here. Beds can be relocated from one location to another. They can be put in layaway status and removed from layaway status, but no new beds. And then the legislature thought, well, we have like more beds right now than we need. This is back in the early 80s or so. But with this moratorium and the aging of our population, at some point we're going to need more beds. We're going to have to lift the moratorium. So let's require the Department of Human Services to give us this report periodically to tell us if we still need the moratorium. That was the initial purpose of this report. We chose to expand it to talk about quality and to talk about financial aspects and then talk about the size of the industry and whether or not we felt like it was time to lift the moratorium. So if you will turn to page 4, I'm going to give you a little more information about quality, and then we'll move on to some of those other topics. Let's go to page four. That's three. So on page four, what you see is a roughly a 6-7 year bar chart showing the change over that period of time in statewide performance on the different quality of life domains. And interestingly, on some of them, the performance has gone down a bit. On some of them, it has improved a bit. Overall, the level of improvement outweighs the level of decline somewhat. If you go to the next page, what you'll see on the quality indicators, that there's one measure, well, three actually, one that declined fairly significantly, and all the rest, and some to even larger degrees, showed improvement. What we're seeing is pretty significant improvement on clinical quality of care taking place. Let's go to, there's an interesting table I want to share with you on page seven. So in this table, it looks at staffing levels, and we have several hospital-attached facilities, a few boarding care facilities, and the majority of our facilities are here. They're called standard. Elsewhere in the report, I'm just noticing now, refer to them as freestanding facilities in that they're not hospital-attached. And what you see from 2006 through 2012 is that staffing levels, and this again is adjusted for acuity and staff type, have actually increased by about 20% in nursing facilities. On the next table, down on that little lower on that page, you see that staff retention is pretty stable. However, it peaked in 2009, early in the period of time when the nation went into a financial crisis, early in the recession. And what you see is that as we've come out of the recession, staff retention, direct care staff retention, has been going down a little bit. I would like to show you on the next page at the bottom is the portion of beds in single-bed rooms, and you can see that in Minnesota we've made a huge amount of progress over the last 8 or 10 years, and that we've gone from 26 to 47% of our beds. And I think when the new report comes out, we'll see that has probably gone up just a little bit. So I'm going to keep kind of paging through this report, directing you to page 12. The other important element of quality is quality improvement. And the Department of Human Services feels that as a major purchaser, currently we are the purchaser for 55% of resident days. I think I shared that statistic with you previously. And as a major purchaser, we have an interest in quality. The state regulates quality, and that those regulations are enforced by the health department. There's licensure regulations, there's regulations that you have to meet to participate in the Medicaid program. So that's kind of an approach. Let's call that the stick. We have a good big stick that we use, but do we have any honey? Do we have any way to say, we want to reward good quality, we want to create incentives for good quality, we want to find ways to make it possible for facilities to focus on improving their quality? That's something that, as a purchaser, we have a strong interest in. So one of the programs that we've been operating since 2006 related to quality is the PIP program, the Performance-Based Incentive Payment Program. And this program, this chart on the top of page 12, shows you two groups of facilities. The blue line is facilities that have participated at some point or in time or another in the PIP program. They've competed to be able to submit a proposal to do a quality improvement process and receive temporary funding increases to allow for that project to take place. Back in 06, what you see is that the two groups of facilities were virtually identical. And as time went by, what you see is that they have diverged a little bit, that the PIP facilities are showing higher quality, and this is looking at the quality indicators specifically, the clinical measures, than the facilities that have never engaged in a PIP project. So this is part of an evaluation of that program. We think it supports the notion that the PIP program is doing some good. So any questions about?
Actually, we have a question from Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was kind of just a smaller question from a while back. When you had the number of single-person rooms, my parents had the privilege of living together really right up until the very end, so they shared a room. So does that account for any of those percentages? You get what I'm saying? We have people that are choosing to live in the same room.
Mr. Hill?
We have, Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, we do have a number of facilities, a pretty small number, that are 100% private rooms. And so it creates a bit of a dilemma for, it could be a couple like your parents, it could be siblings that want to share a room. Most people, frankly, don't go to a nursing home with their spouse or their sibling. But I think many of us would agree that it's probably optimal to have a small portion of shared rooms in a facility that would accommodate that. Or there's also people who really don't want to be alone in a room. But I think many people would prefer not to have to share their bedroom with a stranger in their last years.
Mr. Chair, I agree totally. I just wanted to know what your number is, 73%, if that's not even a little bit skewed because of people that want to live together. I'm just asking. It was not a major question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I'm not sure where the 47% of the beds.
I can't find the chart, but the percentage of single, you've had the growth of the...
It's up here now. Do you remember what page that's on? So it's growing, and I think it's...
Oh, I think it's a good thing, but I'm just wondering if it's even better than that because of situations like...
Yeah.
...wanting to live together, or my parents, or things
right.
like that.
Right. So if you could back those out of the... denominator, they'd even look a little better. It's an interesting point. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Miller, because you don't have a microphone, we kind of need to go through me just to ask the question, if that's okay.
Oh, no problem.
I'm sorry about that, but we only have the one microphone here. So.
No problem.
And any other future questions, if we could do that, so we'll make sure there. And Representative Newton.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Miller, was that nursing home or was that assisted living that your family was in?
Question is for Mr. Miller. Is that for nursing care?
Question, because my parents also were in assisted living together, but when they needed more acute care, they went to private homes.
Mr. Chair, and that's a valid question because actually my parents experienced about every stage of care. So that's one of the questions I've been asking, at which point it becomes a nursing home. Because at end of life, they were in a facility that really had, I mean, my dad passed away first, but when my mom left, she went to hospice, and he died while he was in the room. So I would consider that probably pretty close to nursing. I mean, they had full CNA care and stuff like that, so I don't know if it was considered a nursing home or not. So.
But, Mr. Chair, that's more of a comment than a question. For Mr. Howell, when we look at the moratorium number of beds for nursing homes. Do we look at that geographically? Because I know some areas, we have more of a need for nursing homes and others less of a need. So I'm just wondering, are we looking at that statewide or do we take geographic areas into consideration?
Thank you, Representative Newton. Mr. Hill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newton, the question had to do with getting more refined data on the availability of beds and the moratorium. And if you actually turn to the very back of this report, you'll see a two-page table of very, very small print. And it tells you statistics by county. So it can get very localized. And it gives you the beds per 1,000 for the 65 older and older. It gives you the 85 and older. It gives you those for contiguous county groups. And it also has No, it doesn't. Okay, I'm not going to go there. Okay. So we have that data on a county basis, and I actually have a state map in here, which we'll come to in a bit, that shows that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Mr. or Representative Newton, do you have another question?
And just another comment, when I work on the nursing home facilities for veterans, is that included in this? That's exclusive of this, is that correct?
Thank you, Representative Norton. Newton, Mr. Hill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Newton. There's five veterans homes in the state, and I don't know for sure if they're included in this data or not. This is, let me just look at the title of it and... No, I don't know for sure if those five are included or not. They're not included in most of our data because they don't file reports with us and they don't do MDSs. But we do know how many beds they have, so I'm not sure.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Any further questions, Mr. Representative? Thank you. Mr. Held, we have about 5 minutes left before we need to wrap it up. Oh, 10, I'm sorry, 10 minutes.
Maybe I can bargain for another 15 or something. I will move forward as quickly as I can. On page 13, I just want to point out that this is the financial analysis section, that nursing homes have about $2.35 billion of revenue per year. That's all nursing homes, including non-Medicaid. If you look at the table just below that, it's on the screen here, bottom of page 13. It shows you the MA spending per year going back to 95. And on the following page, what you see is a table that shows you the trend in rates. So we saw just now that the revenues are going down. The total MA spending is going down. The MA rates are going up. And the table below that shows you that the paid MA days are going down. Between the two of those, the revenues are changing in the way that you see on page 13. We have a very interesting analysis starting on page 15. At least, I mean, I find it really fascinating. And this is how well are nursing homes actually performing financially. And what this shows us on the table that's on the screen, bottom of page 15, is a couple things that are of interest. One is that the average daily census over this four-year period has gone from 81 down to 75, so the use of nursing homes is declining. 62% of nursing homes have shown a positive financial performance, and the total financial performance of all nursing homes in the state is $7.7 million, which is well under 1%. It's a third of a percent. That comes to 75 cents per resident day. And interestingly, on the very bottom right, the 3601, that tells you the difference between the Medicaid average rate and average costs. So it's a very curious thing that the average Medicaid rate is $36 less than costs, but cumulatively the nursing homes have made money. And on the next page, there's a detailed discussion of that. And I would just point out that there are a number of revenue sources that nursing homes receive that are not associated with the daily rate that is set by Medicaid. Private paying people pay more, Medicare pays more. We pay for a person in a single bedroom if there's medical necessity, a higher rate for the first 30 days. Facilities that are owned by governmental entities in some cases receive a subsidy from their owner. Nonprofits receive donations and so forth. So we then broke this down in a number of ways. On page 17 is an important distinction, and it's by facility type: hospital-attached, boarding care, or freestanding. 312 freestanding facilities, and what you can see is that on average they were making $7.37 per resident day, while the hospital-attached facilities we're losing $47.17 per day. Hospital-attached facilities often in Minnesota are critical access hospitals. It's a Medicare status that gives them financial benefits but also forces them to allocate a lot of costs to the nursing home that they operate or that's attached to them. In addition, many of those nursing homes have made business decisions to pay wages that are comparable between what they pay in the hospital and what they pay in the nursing home. And both of those are what we believe contribute to that piece. We also did breakdowns by geography.
Yes. I believe we have a question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, I hope you can hear me. I'm trying to talk loud, and maybe Mr. Hill will have to repeat the question. But Mr. Hill, talking about the financial performance of facilities, in 2013, the legislature raised the rates for nursing homes, the Medicaid rates, by 5%. I know it didn't all go into effect right away, perhaps, but could you sort of explain that and how that impacts this? Because as I'm looking at your graphs, it only goes up to, I think, 2011. So this is a little bit of a look back. We're not really seeing such current numbers. And I wonder if you could just fill that in a little bit since we're talking about this right now.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Mr. Hill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, if Stacy would be so kind as to bring me the manila folder in my briefcase, which I forgot to bring to the table with me, I have updated data by two more years on this. And what you're referring to is legislation that provided a rate increase. It felt so thin, I thought it was empty, but... a rate increase effective 9/1/13 that was 3.75% general rate increase, of which a large portion was required to be used for wage increases and associated costs. In addition, there was a quality add-on, which was a variable amount based on measures in the report card. And the question is whether or not that affected their performance. However, I've only got data for 2012 and 2013, and that's the rate year ending 9/30/13. So it actually is not reflected in this data. And but the data does show is that average, I said they made money in 2011, $7.7 million. The following year, the industry's cumulative performance was a net loss of $37.6 million, and the following year, $55.1 million. It's not... a very attractive trend.
Thank you, Mr. Helt.
And the rate increase is right after that data point.
Oh, okay. So if I'm understanding, so that is, I know rates were not raised by the legislature for years when we were in the deficit situations and all that, but as the economy started improving, we started to have more money. We did put money into nursing homes. And if I'm understanding what you're saying is that it's just not reflected here in the data we've got yet, right? Did I kind of get that right, or did I miss your...
Mr. Chair, Representative Langley, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We have one more question, Mr. Held. Representative Keel.
Thank you. I just heard you say that the raise was really, was it 5% or 3.75%?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, I attempted to just say yes. It's both. There was a general rate increase that was the same for everybody, and that's the 3.75. And then there was a quality add-on, which averaged 1.25. So the statewide average rate increase was 5%, but it ranged from 3.75% up to about 6%. Or sorry, about 7%.
Thank you, Marcel. Another question, Representative Keel?
So when I go to visit, I live in northern Minnesota, northwestern corner. When I go to visit my nursing homes, quite often they would tell me that you say it increased by 5%, but in fact we didn't see that at all. They were telling me it was closer to a 3%. Is there, did I misunderstand, or that's what I was getting? Information that was pretty much throughout all my nursing homes.
Mr. Hill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, it would all depend on their quality score. If they had high quality, they would have gotten a big increase, and if they had low quality, it would have been as low as 3.75.
I would challenge the quality, but
there's very few facilities that got absolutely nothing on the quality add-on. Okay. probably about a dozen. I doubt that they're all in that corner of the state. But
thank you, Mr.
We could look at that and get specifics for you on what we actually saw for their, you know, with specific facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Stout. We are down to about 3 minutes, so we have one more question from Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Held, just continuing on the theme, so there's another increase coming, am I correct? That's part of that budget that was passed in 2013, so that, you know, that's kind of the increases. Because of the way the state budgets, going forward 2 years, that, am I right about that? There's another, I think, 3.2 across the board, and the additional add-on for quality is kind of in two bumps. So some of it is still kind of on the way from that, right?
Mr. Hill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, yes, on 10-1-15, current law has a rate increase, and it's 2.4% of a general rate increase with the same requirement, 75% going to wages and other related costs. There's a 0.8% that's tied to quality, not the quality add-on that we talked about earlier, but you may recall me mentioning in prior testimony about the QIP program, the Quality Improvement Incentive Payment Program, which is somewhat like PIP that I just described. However, in the QIP program, it's not competitive. Every facility can sign up and pick a single measure and work on that and get that bump for a one-year period beginning 10-1-15. In fact, all but three facilities did sign up for that program.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Any more questions, Representative Liebling? Okay, 2 minutes to go.
Boy, I don't know how to do this in 2 minutes.
Sorry about
so I referred to a map on page... Oh, that's no. Forget that. Forget it. I want to skip some of this and move ahead to page 31, if I may. And this is getting to that original purpose of this report, the size of the industry. And what you'll see in the red line is the squares, is that the number of beds in Minnesota has been declining ever since 1985. While in fact the number of beds in the U.S. was continuing to grow for several of those years and then started to decline, but only very slowly. If you go to the next page, what you'll see is the beds in Minnesota compared to the U.S. on a beds per thousand comparison. And here's a good display of how much Minnesota was overbedded in terms of the actual per population size and the number of beds. But that Minnesota has made a great deal of progress in beginning to get that down. And I think it's important to understand the reason for that, which is that generally people don't aspire to end up in a nursing home. If you go into a room of seniors and you say to them, how many of you are looking forward to ending up in a nursing home? You're not going to see a lot of hands go up. And they would prefer to receive services in a home and community-based setting, services coming into their own home or being in an assisted living like this and receiving the services that they need. And the state simply cannot afford to do that when it's this overbedded. And so that was what drove it. It allowed the state to and this has been very successful, it allowed the state to redirect those resources to a home and community-based setting by not having them all end up in the nursing home. On the beds per 1,085 and older, which is really the most pertinent of these two measures, we've actually crossed that line and are slightly below the national average. I do want to point out to you a table on page 35. There's a map of Minnesota, the one I referred to earlier, and it shows you kind of the real light colors are the low-bedded counties, and the dark colors are the more heavily bedded counties. And these numbers are a little different from the 65 or the 85 plus. These are what I call age intensity adjusted. And what it does is it adjusts that measure based on the composition of the elderly in 5-year increments. So it's a more sensitive measure than just 65 or 85 plus. And on page 37, we begin a table that concludes on page 38 that shows you the utilization. At any point in time, What portion of the elderly are in a nursing home in Minnesota? Back in 1984, the 85 plus, 36.4% were in a nursing home at any point in time. If you look at the end of the table, that's gone down to 14.1%. These are people that are being served in their homes, and they're being served in assisted living, rather than a more expensive and more restrictive setting, a nursing home. I think, given the time with that, I could use another hour, if you would.
I have about one final question from Representative Urusel.
On the reduction in capacity, was that achieved primarily by converting double rooms to single rooms, or was that due to closing facilities or wings of facilities?
Mr. Held?
Mr. Chair, Representative Urusel, it was all of the above. There were facilities that closed, as we noted earlier. There's been 100 facilities in Minnesota that have closed in the last 20 years or so. We have many facilities that have created single bedrooms by closing a single room. And we have incentives to encourage facilities to do that, or perhaps it would be better to state that as to help cover fixed operating costs when you close beds and you have fewer beds to allocate those costs over. So there's rate adjustments that facilities can get if they close some beds. So we've seen facilities close entirely. We've seen facilities close a number of beds to create singles. They've also created singles by putting on additions so that you can take and move beds into an addition where you're creating new singles and converting old doubles into singles as well. We've seen all of those things happening.
Thank you, Mr. Held. Representative Urusel, do you have a follow-up? Thank you. Well, with that, I think we'll bring the presentation to a close. Thank you, Mr. Held, and thank you, Stacy, for putting on a very nice presentation. Thank you very much. As the testifiers are coming to the table, Representative Woolley would like to have a few comments.
Well, good morning, everyone. Chair Schumacher set up this meeting in Faribault. I'm pretty excited to be back in Faribault. And we've always been a welcoming community. And I love, I happen to be Scandinavian, so you were really smart. You put the Norwegian sweater right in the front and made me feel welcome. Thank you for that. And Representative Daniels, you have your hands full because I served with Representative Fritz, and I think half the bonding bill went to Faribault. We used to joke about that, so you're going to have your hands full trying to get half the bonding bill from all of us because we came down here a lot. I always liked Faribault, and I'm a hockey player, so I always thought I could, but I never made it to the real. I wasn't that good, but to get to Shattuck. But, you know, we all care about the aging issue. It's really important. And thank you to Chair Schumacher for inviting us. I'm jealous of your community. I forgot, you know, we lost ours quite a few years ago, but you have a wonderful A&W root beer store on the way in. And I know we're going somewhere else for lunch maybe afterwards, but I might lean towards A&W. But good luck, Representative Daniels, trying to get half as much as what Patty got. You're going to have your hands full. And we all love Faribault, and excited to hear more about it.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. And I do have my hands full. It's going to be a tough year, especially being a freshman in the House. I think next we'll... we have a list of testifiers, so we'll start with Sandy LeBrand, is that correct? LeBrand, sorry about that. Yep. If you'd please state your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandy LeBrand, and I live in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. As I mentioned, I live in Robbinsdale. However, my aging issues that my family experienced were in my hometown, Mankato. I also serve on two Alzheimer's-related committees in Mankato. the Alzheimer's Association, Walk to End Alzheimer's, and now the Mankato, North Mankato, Act on Alzheimer's Action Team. In 2004, my parents and I planned to visit the World War II Memorial. The day before our flight, my dad called to say that they couldn't go because Mom can't fly. Mom can't was not a phrase associated with my mother. Mom won't, Mom doesn't want to, but not Mom can't. For the next 8 years, we encountered what many people in my hometown have or are encountering today. Last year, actor and comedian Seth Rogen said in his testimony before a U.S. Senate subcommittee, Americans whisper the word Alzheimer's because our government whispers the word Alzheimer's. It needs to be yelled and screamed to the point it finally gets the attention and funding that it deserves. I appreciate the bipartisan support that has been shown for the Alzheimer's Research and Support Act this session. What I appreciate most is hearing legislators tell their own personal story about Alzheimer's, meaning we're starting to move beyond a whisper in this state, but we still need to get louder. I want to share a few things we experienced, beginning with our journey of trying to get a diagnosis. My mom's primary doctor wrote off her symptoms as getting old, so we got a new primary doctor. We told her we wanted to know if she had Alzheimer's. After one appointment, the doctor whispered to me in the hallway, "We don't like to say the word Alzheimer's. We like to say mild cognitive impairment." We also met with a neurologist, but she broke trust with my mom by stomping her foot and telling her that she needed to get walking and not to nap so much. Later, during a hospital stay, my mom had another neurologist. This doctor took our concerns seriously and recommended a 3-hour evaluation from which we received a diagnosis of Lewy body disease. He began to follow my mom, and we found yet another primary doctor. When he moved away, the third neurologist changed her diagnosis again to dementia, not otherwise specified. It was through an autopsy that we learned she had both Alzheimer's and Lewy body disease. If, instead of yelling at my mom, the first doctor had equipped our family with strategies to help her initiate activities, it would have meant a very different quality of life for her, when she still had a lot of capacity to do things, but she just didn't know how to begin them. If we had had the right diagnosis, our family might have found our way to the Alzheimer's Association and learned about all their amazing resources and education before she died, not afterward. Sadly, even with the team I was comfortable with, I believe my mom was given too many antipsychotic medications. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services recently revised their nursing home survey guidelines to reduce antipsychotic medications for dementia care after finding 80% of antipsychotics prescribed in nursing homes were for off-label conditions. These medications increase the risk of death, fall with fractures, hospitalizations, and other complications resulting in poor health and high cost. It was after my mom's 9th fall in less than 2 months that led to a hip fracture and her death, none of which was reported to the state. Almost all individuals on antipsychotics, also known as chemical restraints, were admitted with a prescription already in place. Therefore, I would like to see some standard apply to all people living with dementia, not just those in nursing homes. The standard could be applied in the doctor's office, the emergency room, geriatric psych units, assisted living, and memory care settings. As an aside, there is no report card for either of those settings. In addition, a growing body of research suggests that well-targeted non-drug therapies, such as touch, music, and aromatherapy, may help reduce certain behavioral issues. My parents also had out-of-pocket expenses at over $170,000 the last 2 years of my mom's life. That with Medicare, supplemental insurance, and a long-term care policy that they'd had since 1995. I personally missed 21 weeks of work, many without pay. I know many of you have heard the devastating statistics related to Alzheimer's disease. I hope I've been able to shed light on other things that add pain to pain. Getting a diagnosis, resources, overuse of antipsychotics, and the unsustainable costs. The Alzheimer's Association calls people committed to their vision of a world without Alzheimer's champions. I'm looking for political champions who are willing to shout about Alzheimer's, its impact, and to solve problems. With that, I would recommend that this committee and other committees continue to look to the 2011 legislative report called Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's, the Budgetary, Social, and Personal Impacts. Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And my heart goes out. My mother and mother-in-law both died of dementia. I know where you're coming from.
Thank you. Too many of us do.
Yes. Very good. Thank you so much. Now, we can bring the microphone a little bit portable. Is that correct?
Yep.
So if you can't make it to the chair, if you don't want to make the chair, just let us know and we'll get the microphone to you. Next one on the list is Mary Margaret Lehman. Is that correct?
Lehman.
Yes. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record, please.
My name is Mary Margaret Lehman. I'm a resident of Edina, Minnesota. And good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share my husband Ken's story and my story with you today. Ours is just one of millions of stories told, each one a little different, but each one so heartfelt. The sad part is that most of these stories remain behind closed doors. Our story is difficult to tell, but Ken and I made the choice to tell it all if we are going to make a difference, especially with our legislators and decision makers. Plus, the more we share our story and talk about Alzheimer's, we have found the more others are willing to engage in conversation, and the less of a stigma it will become for others facing the disease. The fear factor regarding Alzheimer's is frightening itself. Ken's tentative diagnosis came in 2009. However, I became aware of changes in his personality and behaviors as far back as 1995, when we were still living in California. He was 58 years old. Ken was always referred to by our friends as a Renaissance man. Everyone was in awe of his rapid rise to executive of a large furniture company. He taught classes in design and history of furniture at the college level one or two evenings a week. He played basketball, tennis, rebuilt his Porsche engine twice. He was and still is a gifted artist and now a woodworker as well. He was and still is a wonderful dad, grandfather, and loving husband. We had many friends, and we loved to entertain. So it was significant when he began to withdraw from family and friends in social situations and his favorite activities. He also began to have difficulty navigating familiar places and following conversations. But most disconcerting was that his executive functioning involving problem-solving, judgment, and reasoning were compromised, especially in regard to our finances. We were both patients of a well-known and highly respected internist for over 30 years. He knew us both well. Over 14 years, I reported my observations of Ken's to him. Our doctor brushed off my concerns that these signs might be serious by first responding that I was overreacting. Another time, his response was, "Well, these things can happen." And yet another, "Well, this could be just part of his aging." No, he did not think he was depressed. I could not accept that I was overreacting, nor that I was observing part of his aging, but I would tuck away my fears until the next time and the next. In retrospect, most distressing is that our doctor never, ever suspected Alzheimer's, or at least voiced it. I was aware that difficulties with memory could be a sign of Alzheimer's, but for Ken, memory was not an issue. It is research, both empirical research and scientific research, that has identified 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's. It is research that will continue to identify more pieces of the puzzle of this mysterious disease called Alzheimer's. The wake-up call for me that there might be something really serious involved as a result of Ken's changes in behavior and personality came when he told me, "We have to file for bankruptcy." His compromised financial judgment had escalated to our financial failure. Subsequently, we lost our home as well. I remember during the chaos of these days, Ken saying, "I don't really know who I am anymore." And I was left thinking, how could this have happened to us? I encouraged Ken to see another doctor to learn the reasons why. And after seeing a total of 4 neurologists and 3 internists, both in California and Minnesota, Ken was finally given a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease at the Center for Memory and Care from Dr. Michael Rosenblum. Unfortunately, our story is not too unique. Too many people, including doctors and even neurologists, do not know the 10 warning signs of Alzheimer's. Many families struggle to get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, just like we did. Many families go through financial disaster, just like we did. I'm aware of doctors actually admitting out loud that they prefer not to give a diagnosis of Alzheimer's because there's no cure, there's nothing anyone can do about it, and ignorance really could be bliss. After receiving the diagnosis, Ken was in denial and depressed, and I was devastated and desperate as to how and where we were going to live. And as the caregiver, I realized this was now going to be my responsibility. So I chose to move to Minnesota to be close to our daughter, the best decision I've ever made in my life. But I am here to tell you that knowing the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is far better than not knowing. It was a friend, actually, who suggested I call the Alzheimer's helpline. I now refer to it as my Alzheimer's lifeline. My life and my love's life changed from despair to hope. I connected with a warm, caring care consultant who immediately became my best friend. She listened to me, assured me, understood me. She was empathetic and compassionate. However, she also informed us that there is no cure, that my love would eventually become incapacitated. He may be bedridden and need 24-hour care, day in and day out, perhaps year in and year out. Through the Alzheimer's Association, Ken and I became educated. We were came to a place of acceptance of our disease. I say our disease because I'm living it along with him. We learned how it would impact us and how it can impact others living with the disease. We wanted to give back. So we chose to become advocates, to speak up and speak out for all of us on this journey. Today, there are 5 million others living in America with this same death sentence. There are 15 million caregivers at their sides, emotionally and physically exhausted, many ill themselves due to the toll of the stress. Every day, over the next 19 years, 10,000 baby boomers are turning 65. 1 out of 9 is expected to get Alzheimer's. As these baby boomers turn 85, one out of three will have Alzheimer's. These numbers are staggering. New memory care facilities are popping up everywhere. In fact, right next door to us, in Edina, right next to our apartment home, there's going to be a groundbreaking of a beautiful new facility. There are actually about six or seven other beautiful care facilities for memory care in Edina. The average cost is $8,000 per month. None of them accept Medicaid or elderly waiver. The mantra in our caregiver support is, in our my caregiver support group is, with Alzheimer's, you either go bankrupt before the diagnosis as a result of the disease, or afterwards when you run out of money for care as a result of the disease. Either way, many of us living with Alzheimer's disease will be contributing to the bankruptcy of the country through Medicaid and Medicare as a result of the disease. It's not just bankruptcy. An epidemic is well upon us, and too many families are in situations like ours, facing a fatal brain disease that currently has no way to prevent, cure, or even slow its progression. We must make the smart investment now to realize a better, healthier future for our nation, our state, and our families. More research is our only hope. Hope is all we have at this time. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you very much. We have eight more testifiers. So just a reminder, if we can keep the testimonies to about 3 to maybe 5 minutes. Next on our list is Cheryl Gustafson. Is that correct?
Gustafson.
Thank you for coming.
Not having the
off. And please state your name for the record.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Cheryl Gustafson. I'm an administrator at the Fieldcrest Care Center in Hayfield, Minnesota, population 1,340. We're located in southeastern Minnesota. I am also a member of the Leading Age Minnesota Board of Directors. Fieldcrest is a small, rural, city-owned senior campus. We have a 45-bed nursing home with an attached 9-unit assisted living complex and 20 housing with services senior apartments. Our home care agency provides needed care for both the assisted living and senior apartments. We are one of the largest employers in Hayfield and the only employer that provides health care. Our therapy department provides therapy to the care center residents as well as residents of Hayfield and surrounding area. We have no clinic in the community. The closest hospitals are St. Mary's in Rochester, 30 miles away, and Austin Medical Center, 22 miles away. Fieldcrest employs 85 dedicated, caring individuals that provide excellent care for our seniors and our campus. 61% of our operating budget is dedicated to caregiver wages and benefits. The majority of our caregivers are local community members that have grown up in Hayfield and stayed in Hayfield because they have been able to work at the care center. We have multiple generations of family members that work at the care center. In fact, many of our employees have had family members that have been residents in the care center. As a provider of senior care services, one of the biggest challenges I face is recruitment and retention of quality caregivers. The legislature has tied our hands for way too long with little to no increases in reimbursement for the loving care we give our seniors. I cannot afford to pay our dedicated employers what they are worth. Fieldcrest has struggled financially for the past several years. Our costs to run the care center have increased, but the reimbursement has not. In the past 2 years, we have seen an increase in our health insurance of 44% and work comp insurance 41%. I have also had increases in utilities, food costs, and health care products. I cannot keep up with the rising cost of care. Due to our proximity to Rochester Mayo Clinic, we are in a constant struggle to provide competitive wages and benefits to our staff. Mayo currently needs to hire 100 RNs and 60 LPNs. Mayo also pays the nurses $8 to $10 more per hour, and they have no problem recruiting our nurses. In a community close to Hayfield, Burger King is offering $14 per hour with no experience. We start our CNAs out at $11.61. In the past month, we lost two of our RNs and two of our LPNs because of wages. To a small care facility like ours, that is a major loss. Minnesota faces a current caregiving workforce crisis, and it will only get worse without adequate funding for our senior care. In the next two-week pay period, our care center has 35 open nurses' shifts and 62 open CNA shifts, and those shifts have to be filled. We ask our caregivers to volunteer to work double shifts, and when we can't get the shifts filled, we mandate staff to stay. We also have had to utilize pool staff to fill open shifts. We do not do this. We do this out of necessity. We don't do the pool shifts out of choice. In 2014, we paid $86,000 out in pool. We paid out $34,000 in overtime and $18,274 extra shift pickup pay. And that pickup pay is the equivalent of 7,308 open shifts that were picked up by our staff. We have had nurses, as well as the director of nursing, working the floor in the capacity of direct caregivers. Our social worker, who is also a certified nursing assistant, helps to fill the shifts as well. Working like this has taken a toll on my staff. They are exhausted. Morale is low. And at times, some have even called in sick prior to their shifts, so they won't be mandated to work that double. I have even had to stop accepting admissions because the caregivers were pushed to their limits, and I couldn't afford to lose any more of my excellent workers. When we, as an employer, can't pay a living wage, and the state freezes or cuts our wages year after year, that sends a clear message about the value of this workforce. And it's the wrong message. Please, please send the right message about how important caregivers are to Minnesota seniors and families. Please show them that you care. Again, I want to thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Representative Daniels. This year, Chair Schumacher has a big bill to increase the funding for nursing homes. And I think it was $300 million, perhaps, or more.
Who knows?
Quite a bit of money. But just to be clear, some of us had a big effort to see that much of that goes to what the person just said. Right now, and then it goes to the testimony from the gentleman from the state, and then quality rating and the less turnover, and just translates into quality care. So that's kind of, some of that was perceived as pure politics, but really it is a real problem, and really we should make a big effort to make sure that as much of the money goes to the wages as possible. So that's kind of what we're thinking. And today we had some good news, as we're all might be peeking at our phones if you see us, is because the surplus is coming out, and that's actually good news. A couple years ago, that's political, but we raised taxes and whatever, but there's a surplus, and we're hoping that some of that money goes to fund the chair's the bill and to see that money goes to staffing.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Next testifier we have is Anna Sheridan. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And if you'd state your name for the record, please.
My name is Anna Sheridan, and I am the administrator at Pleasant Manor Nursing Home here in Faribault, Minnesota. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Our communities, families, caregivers, and the state are facing a daunting challenge in the years to come. Minnesota will see 60,000 new seniors each year in the coming age wave. For the first time, seniors will outnumber school-aged children, and this trend will not change in the foreseeable future. These seniors are the very same people who have raised their families in our communities, worked in our communities, and have contributed immensely to the fabric of our communities, our state, and our country. These statistics of the coming age wave mean two things to care providers. We're going to see more demand for services, and we're going to need a lot more quality caregivers. Currently, some of the biggest challenges facing nursing facilities in our region is a difficulty in recruiting and retaining caregivers, just as Cheryl had said. Our wages and benefits just aren't competitive with other employees, both at the entry level and at nursing positions. The majority of new nursing program students come to senior care facilities. They have to because they have to have 1 year of experience before they can apply for a job at a hospital. Once they hit that 1 year mark, they move on to a hospital where they are paid tens of thousands of dollars, if not more. We compete with hospitals and their pay for entry-level employees. For instance, a nurse needs at least the 1 year of experience, and we start our nurses off at anywhere from $24 to 53 cents per hour or less, depending on their experience. At a hospital, their starting pay is $35 all the way up to $41.78 per hour. That means a wage gap of $10 all the way up to $17.25 per hour. These very same nurses and caregivers are taking care of our seniors, who we value a lot. I want to share some personal stories that staff had written to me. I have an RN who works 32 hours a week at our nursing facility. She was not able to make enough money paying her bills, so she took a part-time job at the hospital. The hospital part-time job paid her about the same amount of money, if not more, than what we could pay her. So why does she stay? She loves the residents. She stated most don't have family locally. They rely on us as caregivers to be there for them, take care of them, visit with them, and love them. I am that person who wants to make a difference in their life. I want to make them smile. I want to see them get excited over the little things that we take for granted each day. This is why I stay. I love my residents. Another story is I'm a mother of four children. My husband and I both work full-time, and our extended family have to help to take care of our children. I pick up extra shifts and work 50 to 65 hours a week just so I can pay my bills and maybe buy a treat or two for my kids or take them to the pool or do something fun. All of my money is spent on paying the bills. The cost of living continues to rise. Gas, milk, bread, heating. Everything is going up and costing more. The small raises I get I'm thankful for, but it's just not enough to pay the bills. The turnover rate in our region, the average turnover rate for an RN is 47%. The average rate for an LPN is 55%. And even higher is a CNA and a TMA at 68%. We struggle to keep our staff because we can't pay them. They love our residents. They love what they do, but they can't afford to stay. Our employees are committed to taking care of our residents. They work very, very hard each and every day to make a difference in their life. Quality of care is best provided with a constant, stable workforce. Constant turnover means that the staff don't really know our residents. They don't know that little thing that makes an extraordinary difference in the care. That is why we need your help in reforming the system for paying for senior care, so we are able to take care of our seniors at the level and quality of care they have earned and they deserve after their years of service to their families and communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. We are running a little bit short on time. We probably have, 8 minutes left? I think we have seven people that would like to give their testimony, so if we could shorten those up just a little bit, if we could. Next is Andrea, is it Lingle?
Yep, you got it.
Oh, man, first time.
I have to say I'm impressed as well, so thank you.
Thank you for coming. If you could state your name for the record.
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andrea Lingle, and I work for Lutheran Social Service and the Senior Nutrition Program as a senior program manager. I am also the president of the Minnesota Senior Nutrition Providers Association. Lutheran Social Service, or LSS, Senior Dining and Meals on Wheels seeks to enable persons aged 60 years old or older to live healthier, more active, and independent lives. The overall goal of the Senior Nutrition Program is to delay or prevent unnecessary institutionalization of older adults, thereby reducing costs and burdens on taxpayers of medical assistance-funded care, healthcare systems, and skilled nursing facilities. The meals are open to anyone aged 60 or older in the community, and most of the seniors we serve live on very limited incomes. Currently, LSS serves as the provider of Senior Nutrition Program in 39 counties, reaching mostly rural Minnesotans in Northwest, Central, Southwest, and South Central regions in the state, including communities such as Waseca, Montgomery, and LaCenter. Our program is heavily supported by volunteers. In 2014, we were 5,169 volunteers strong, serving 106,665 hours. We would like to thank you for your support in the 5% rate increase for home and community-based services last year. Your help made it possible to bring wages to the new minimum wage of $8. It also helped us to cover rising food costs that have directly affected our cooking kitchens and our caterers. With that said, costs continue to rise. A rate increase in 2015 and 2016 will help us continue to provide services so older adults can maintain their independence in the community. In October, the site manager in Cross Lake received a call from a daughter of a home-delivered client. The daughter was concerned because her father seemed confused and disorientated in a phone conversation the previous evening. The daughter asked if the home delivery volunteer could spend a few extra minutes with her father to see how he was doing. Our site manager asked the volunteer if he would do this, and he was very willing to help. When the volunteer went to the home to deliver the meal, no one answered the door. The door was unlocked, and after consulting with the site manager, the volunteer entered the home with permission from the daughter. The volunteer found the client had fallen out of bed and was wedged between the bed and the wall. Emergency help was contacted and the client was taken to the hospital while the daughter was kept informed. This is an excellent example of the extra efforts of staff and volunteers and how they go beyond just providing a meal. They are sometimes a lifeline for our clients and family members. In addition, our program continues to work with medical assistance programs throughout the counties in our area. The inability to collect spend downs from those receiving assistance has been a continued problem from our program, along with providers across the state. LSS alone absorbed $26,752 in 2014. We welcome your support for MA reform to help sustain a stable future for providers of programs like ours. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you much, very much for coming. Thank you. Next we have on the list is Andrea Miller. Thank you for coming. And then please state your name for the record.
My name is Andrea Miller. I'm a direct support professional with Lutheran Social Services here in Faribault. I work with individuals with intellectual disabilities. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. Thank you also for the 5% rate increase last year. Even with that 5% rate increase, many of my coworkers hold down 2 to 3 jobs just to make ends meet. In order to build an effective team to care for the people we support, we need to have staff members who feel respected and valued. Many staff look for other work to take care of their families. The people we serve thrive on routine and trust. When staff come and go, it is difficult to maintain the routine and even more perilous for them to develop trust in new staff. The years of trust I have built with the people I serve, 8 years in some cases, give them the confidence to come to me when they need to talk about the stresses in their lives. And they do talk to me when other staff members leave. When the people they liked are not coming around anymore, we talk about how much we miss them, and we talk about getting to know the new staff people. It is difficult when people come and go out of our lives, but when working with people who have intellectual disabilities, it can be even more difficult for them to understand why people leave. Would you like a new person coming in each day to help you brush your teeth or give you a shower when you just met them last week? Staff turnover affects more than the bottom line and budgets. It affects the lives of some of the most vulnerable people in Minnesota. I support a person who has aggressive behaviors and needs specialized supports. It seems just when a new staff member gets trained in and comfortable with her needs, they find a higher paying job elsewhere. I love the fresh energy of new coworkers, but there is something priceless about the years I have with the people I serve. I know the people I serve. I can tell when something's not right about their energy or appetite, the color of their face. And that makes me able to advocate with their doctors for thorough care. I urge each of you to support a 5% rate increase so that we can maintain quality services in our community for people with disabilities and older adults. Thank you all so very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming again. Okay, we are at noon, but we're gonna run a little bit late here, so if they can keep your testimony to, you know, 2 or 3 minutes would be great. Next one is Dustin Lee. Thank you for coming, sir. State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Dustin Lee. I live in Greater Mankato. My wife told me not to get off message, but I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I was a soldier, and unlike Brian Williams, I was in Fallujah. And I'm not sure who has the tougher job. I'm the chief operating officer for Prairie Senior Cottages. Our standalone cottages are specifically designed memory care facilities, which serve those with memory loss. We have 6 locations all throughout rural Minnesota. We've been operating since 1998. I try not to use the words patient, resident, customer, client. They are people. Our largest site serves 20 people. They were sons, fathers, daughters, mothers, now grandparents, and great-grandparents. In total, we serve 109 people. 40% of the people that we serve are on the Elderly Waiver Program. They are elderly, poor, and suffering from dementia. They are society's most vulnerable adults. Despite being 40% of our customers, they are less than 30% of our revenue. We employ approximately 120 caregivers. Our average caregiver earns $11.50 per hour. I thank God each and every day for our employees, or our heroes, as I call them, who trade their lives for $11.50 an hour, which doesn't even provide them a meaningful or living wage. Soon, their meager wages will be slightly higher than minimum wage. I suspect most in this room know the Glenn Campbell song, Rhinestone Cowboy. Thanks to the courage of his family and the public being introduced to the ravages of Alzheimer's disease through his documentary, All Be Me, and just last week, Julianne Moore's winning of an Academy Award for Best Actress in portraying the life of Dr. Alice Holland as she comes face to face with a devastating diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's. Each day, I work with people like Glenn Campbell and Dr. Alice Holland. I meet their families and I support our caregivers. The only difference is they are not famous. I'd like to share with you about the people and families we care about and we provide. To protect their privacy and dignity, I will use different names. While the names have been changed, the stories are real. The youngest person we have served is my age, 46 years old. His name is Jim. In his working life, he was a teacher. Another person we presently serve is Harry. Harry is a former state legislator. He just moved into our cottages 2 months ago. Alzheimer's does not discriminate, and it is not kind. Harry may struggle to form a simple sentence, and this is a true story. He still knows which party he's affiliated with. And then there is Irene, who just turned 101 this week. If you ask Irene her age, she will smile at you, gently stroke your face, and tell you she stopped counting at 350. And this story I just heard yesterday. And this is Jerry. For the past few months, when you go to talk to Jerry, he talks like this. This Monday, his nurse came back from vacation. And when he walked up to her, he touched her gently on the shoulder. And he said in a crystal clear sentence, "I thought you weren't coming back." So let me briefly tell you about our heroes, our staff. Julie. Julie works two full-time jobs, 1 a.m. in long-term care, another in our PMs in our assisted living. This way, she avoids public assistance for her and her child. Julie is tougher than most, gives more than most, and is proud and a fierce fighter for the people she serves. And then there's Jenna, who just had a baby. She's attempting to raise her child with no meaningful paid leave. She has no safety net. She lives in her parents' unfinished basement and depends on friends for free daycare. She cannot afford a car. She cannot afford taxi service, and the community in which she lives in does not have viable transportation. When she cannot find a ride to work, she walks 1.5 miles each day, and her attendance is perfect. The list of heroes goes on and on. When our families come to us, they've spent on average 10 years of caregiving, and they can't take it anymore. When they walk through our doors, they are exhausted, they are scared, they are feeling guilt, as they are no longer physically or emotionally able to provide for their bride, the one that they promised till death do us part. Our services could be provided in a nursing home. They would be more expensive, but certainly less home-like than the environment we provide. Henry Ford once said, "Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right." Let me tell you what you can do this legislative session to improve the lives of the caregivers and the employees and the people that we serve. First, please restore parity between the elderly waiver program and the nursing home program by connecting the caps of the EW program to the nursing home rates. This will help ensure seniors don't have to move to nursing homes simply because they hit their payment caps. Second, provide a rate increase to the elderly waiver program. We struggle to pay our caregivers a livable wage based on the current rates. A rate increase will send a positive message to the caregivers that they're really valued. And remember Henry, who once was in your shoes. One day, you too may need a caregiver. And one day, you may need somebody like me to advocate for somebody like you. One quote I love is, I did the best I knew, and when I knew better, I did better. The heroes I work with, the people and their families in which we serve, are asking you, please, help us all do better. Thank you so much. I'm sorry I went over time, and thank you for your service to the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your service to the nation, and thank you for your testimony. It's nice to see such passion coming from everybody and the stories. It's, I don't mind going long myself because this is so valuable and very, very, I love the passion. I just love the passion. Next, we have Sue Knutson. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much. My name is Sue Knutson, and I'm the mission leader, CEO of Samaritan Bethany in Rochester. Samaritan Bethany has been serving seniors in our community for over 93 years. We offer skilled nursing, assisted living, memory care, short-term rehab, and independent housing options to approximately 650 seniors every year. We are guided by our faith and our mission to provide compassionate, individual-directed care in a household manner. And we employ approximately 400 staff members. If we're fully staffed, we would have 450. Currently, we have an entire household of 14 beds that we have not been able to fill since the end of November because we don't have staff to work. We currently, in this pay period that we're in right now of 14 days, I have 274 open shifts in nursing assistants, RNs, and LPNs. And that doesn't include anybody calling in sick. So as a provider of senior care services, the thing that keeps me up at night, and unfortunately almost every night, is how do we retain and get new employees? Since November, we've lost about 30% of our licensed staff to Mayo, completely due to wages. Some are making up to $12 an hour more than we can pay. We have a new Aldi store coming in Rochester. They're advertising that they'll pay $15 so you can check groceries. The starting a nursing assistant at Samaritan Bethany makes $12.42 an hour, and they work very hard. Even though as rewarding as it is, it doesn't put milk and bread on their table. I lay awake at night wondering how do we continue to give quality, as Bob was showing, to the residents. Where do I find the workers? It's hard to find someone now. What's going to happen in 5 years where we have more seniors and less workers? How do I retain those workers? I've been at Samaritan Bethany for 18 years in various roles, and it's getting harder and harder every year when they ask what the wage increase is going to be. And I tell them I have no idea, but please hang in there. I lay awake at night knowing that there's not enough staff and that the residents know that there's not enough staff. I see the frustration in employees, and I know they want to do the best they can, but they just don't have enough hours in the day to do it. They deserve better than this. We talked about the rate increase a few years ago in 2013. I think Representative Liebling said that we spent all of ours on wages. It was a choice by our board of directors that every cent had to go to our employees. Under the current state's approach to reimbursement, I don't know from year to year if I'm going to get an increase or what they would be. I don't know what to tell my staff anymore. As a campus that provides both skilled nursing and home and community-based services, it continues to be difficult to provide wage increases to all of our employees when only one part gets an increase. I urge you to look at supporting the entire spectrum of senior care services and not just one segment. At Samaritan Bethany, we act on the belief that we were sent to serve and that caregiving is a mission that deserves respect and honor. I urge you to act this year to honor seniors and their caregivers by prioritizing these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Andy Viola. Thank you for coming. Thank you. State your name for the record, please.
Okay. My name is Eddie Viola, and thank you for letting me testify, Mr. Chair and members. I've been a director of nursing at St. Lucas Care Center, and I've been a nurse for 24 years, four with the United States Air Force and 20 as a civilian. And I've worked with seniors because they're our history, and we need to take care of them because they've already taken care of us. As a Minnesotan living longer and the baby boomers are turning 65, it's more likely that they will need forms of senior care. All seniors deserve quality care, and the state will need to devote more resources to that care. At St. Lucas, we've been unable to respond to the demands of our seniors because of the caregiver shortage. As a director of nursing, I've had to work the floor as a nursing assistant and as a floor nurse. So I can't provide the care overall. I'm just doing one section. We've had to stop admissions because we don't have enough caregivers to take care of them. So now they can't stay in their community. They have to go outside their community. We need to have better quality care and to best provide with a consistent, stable workforce. This is why workforce development and caregiver investments are so critical to us. Our local Walmart and Quick Trip have taken our staff, also Mayo and also across the street, District 1, with better pay and hours. We need to reform our system for paying for senior care so it reflects our shared values, paying caregivers in honorable ways, supporting initiatives and qualities. Our current system lacks predictability for management and our workers as to how much the legislator will allocate each year. We need a system that will fully fund what we all believe is needed for quality care. We need to make sure the investments is equal to the care expected by seniors, their family, and all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next we have Amanda Gruber, please. Thank you for coming. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Amanda Gruber. I work at Three Links Care Center in Northfield, but I'm a resident of Faribault, Minnesota. Good morning, and thank you all for allowing us to voice our concerns. I have made a difference as a nursing assistant for nearly 20 years, and all of the improvements we have seen throughout the years, we have yet to see the staff compensated for the skills and care in an adequate amount. I personally struggle to paycheck to paycheck, as well as many of the other employees that I work with. Many of the employees I work with have more than two jobs and often make more money as a server or as a customer service representative than as a care provider. We are there because we care for the residents, not for the paycheck. The problem arises when we are financially strained and have to choose between making enough money to care for our family and our children and working at a job that we love, caring for our residents. We have lost so many caring and wonderful staff due to inadequate wages. With an increase in wages, we could hire and retain the quality staff who are there for the people. We appreciate the increase that we've had in the past more than I can express, but it's simply not enough. Quality staff needs quality compensation. Nursing homes are stigmatized as a scary place, but to those who work and live at Three Links Care Center, the Dementia Unit, and Pathways, it is a home with care. We are working towards a culture change with Awake at Will programs, blended workers, focusing on resident-centered care. We personalize activities and meals as much as we can. We are educated on dementia, and we use non-pharmaceutical approaches as much as possible. We care about each person that lives there and works there. We know them by name. We know what they like, what they dislike. We can calm them as dementia is ravishing their brains. And sometimes we are all the family that they have. Caregiving is difficult, heart-wrenching, and exhausting. And after we struggle with a difficult day with dementia residents, we still go home and we have to care for our families and our children. We do it for them, for those who can't live at home, for those who need our help. We are their advocates, we are their cheerleaders, their confidants, and their friends, and sometimes the only family they have. Our residents rely on us, and we can't let them down. We work with low wages for as long as we are able. And then the day comes when we have to decide, do we do it for our children and have enough money working at Walmart or at Aldi's, or do we do it for our residents? We are changing to make nursing homes a home with care. And I challenge you today to change the way we express how the government and how we value our staff and our residents. Thank you very much for everything today.
Hey, thank you for your testimony very much. You guys are heroes. Last on our testifier list is Jennifer Johnson. Thank you for coming. And if you could state your name for the record, please.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Johnson, and I work at Millstream Commons. I live in Northfield. I am 35 years old. I am married and have three children. The reason why I'm here today is to talk about why I feel we need to increase the wages in assisted livings and nursing home places. For one, the cost of living goes up every year, and we never see any compensation for it. I have three kids that want to play sports, which are all very expensive. And with only making a little over $10 an hour, we have to choose what they can and cannot play. My daughter plays softball, which in itself is $300. I have recently taken on a second job to compensate for the extra things that we need on a day-to-day basis, and we live paycheck to paycheck. For retirement benefits, it is impossible to save for retirement and when we have low wages. And what is being done about the wage differential between the CNAs that work in hospitals and the CNAs that work in assisted living and nursing homes? I don't believe it's fair when a person with the same qualifications as I do make more because they work in a hospital or a facility that is state operated. I have a sister that works in Iowa at a veteran's home, starting out making $12 an hour back in 2000, and now makes $22 an hour and gets free family insurance. Also, with the quality of care, if we had higher wages, we would be able to keep better staff. The good ones that are reliable are more apt to leave their job because they can work somewhere that makes better pay. The quality of care goes down when we have new staff that have to be trained in because attendants feel anxious and a lot of security when they don't have the consistency of staff on a day-to-day basis. So if we could keep the same staff for longer periods of time, the tenants and residents would absolutely benefit from that. And I want to say thank you for listening to what I have to say and for what I'm standing up for. Also for every man and woman that pours their heart into their job like I do. I love what I do, and this is what I have chosen to do for my career. I go to work for a paycheck, but I also go to work for them, because without us, they might not get the care that they need.
Thank you. Thank you for what you hear. Well, that concludes the testimony. We have Representative Keel. Would you like to make a statement?
Thank you. Yes. Oh, thank you. Members, this reinforces the loan forgiveness program also in this conversation. I know we haven't put a dollar amount for sure to that, but I wanted the residents and the members here to know that the bill is to propose to help anybody who, not anyone, doctors, dentists, nurses, especially nurses who work in nursing home situations, along with mental health professionals, to be able to finish their degree and move to a more rural setting is the emphasis, where they need to commit at least 3 to 4 years of time working. Hopefully they'll decide to reside in those areas and stay there, but it will also help them to defray the cost of their college, their education. It won't be complete. It is closer to 60%, I believe, of their loans. But the point is that we want to encourage and help people that are we would like to move out into the rural areas to provide. This is a story. I appreciate all your testimony. I hear it in my district all the time. It's very frustrating, and as many of us have personal stories about family that are either have Alzheimer's or we've dealt, we're all going to be looking for senior care, unless we don't make it that far. But generally, most everyone will look for some type of senior care, whether it's in the homes or not. But I wanted to point out that that's one of the things that we're looking at. The other thing that I wanted to point out was that the raises that we've given, I happened to have a nurse call the other day, and I said, so tell me what you do with that increase. And she said, we split it up. We decided we'd give our CNAs 15% increase. They still don't make much. We're not talking about $20 an hour. We're talking about maybe 11 instead of 10 or 12 instead of 11. LPNs got a 12% increase, and the RNs got 1 to 2% increase. But they were really in desperate need of also trying to keep those people in those facilities and not losing jobs to other areas where they were not only getting a better pay increase, but also medical benefits. They were getting a lot of benefits. So we've really had some competition. The other competition that I would point out, I was it was interesting to hear about Iowa and what they're getting. I live on the North Dakota border, and I have the same problem at North Dakota. I watch a lot of my nurses' aides go from Minnesota to North Dakota because they can still live at home, and it's, you know, 10 minutes down the road, and they're getting paid at least $15 an hour to start as a CNA. And so that makes it very difficult for us to provide. And we're, you know, I hear, I'm sure we have all heard all these stories that are very challenging for our nursing homes, our, let's say, our aging facilities, even disabilities. I have a gal who is a quadriplegic, and she is trying to run a PCA business, and she can't even hire someone herself. And she can't get out of her wheelchair. So she has no way to take care. I mean, she can't even get a drink of water by herself. So I just, you know, I want you to understand that this, I really appreciate the time we spent. Thank you, Chair, and for setting this up. It just is just a really important conversation all over Minnesota. This is just a serious, serious issue. And I think as we as members certainly need to make sure that we're remembering this when we're talking about our budget and what we're going to do, and hopefully can start to resolve this. I don't think this is an overnight issue, and you obviously know it's a long-term issue. But I thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keel. We have Representative Mason would like to make some comments.
First of all, thank you all, that everyone that's been here, and this has been a long hearing, so I appreciate your patience, and more than that, the what it took to share some of the stories I know is huge. And it's just impossible to state how much stress is both on the caregivers, on the seniors and their families. It's and I think it's been difficult for all of us, but yet I want to say what's been said here today, I've heard before. And that is what is probably more difficult than anything. And in some of my earlier years in the legislature, we'd end and we didn't get the raises. And that's, you know, at least in 2013 and 14, we were able to do something. And what's more, this is where people expect their tax dollars to be going. So again, I appreciate what you said. Even more, you need to be going out into communities to build up support so that we can pass the bills that need to be passed. We've got a lot of good bills coming before our committee, and they need to be passed. And we haven't told you what the figures are, but the figures that were coming out this morning about the surplus, it is a much more positive than we had thought. So hopefully, at least in the short term, whatever we can do, this is one of the areas that needs to be done. But again, it's going to take a lot of grassroots efforts because there is still a lot of competition out there as well. But thank you again, everybody.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Lilly, I think you're next. I'm sorry, Lindley, I'm sorry.
Right. Well, I just also wanted to thank those of you who spoke and those of you who attended. I mean, the stories are really incredible. And the one thing that I just want to kind of go back to is Mr. Lee's characterization of the people doing this work as heroes. And I really do believe that. I echo that. Those of you who are doing this caregiving, some of you spoke about the caregiving that you do. You really are heroes. And we shouldn't forget that. You know, sometimes we talk about our military heroes. Of course they're heroes. And we talk about our firefighters and other kinds of heroes. But we should never forget that many people just going to work every day and doing a tough job, often for very little wages, also are heroes. One of the other big things that I heard, and, you know, I'm pleased that the last couple of years we were able to do more in this area after many years of even cuts that were made during our times of deficit, as terrible as that is to think about, we're just sort of starting to climb out of a hole. But one thing I really heard that I think is very important is the need for predictability. And several of you mentioned that. And I am going to take a look, and I hope others on the committee will take a look at whether we can build something into our state budgeting to make sure that there are, that we don't do this up and down cycle that we've been on. And so, you know, just to be really clear about what's going on, you know, we in Minnesota are very proud that we actually, as much as we're hearing of all the difficulties, we do better than a lot of states. And that's because Minnesotans are willing to pay for that. Minnesotans do pay higher taxes than some other places. In the last couple of years, we did raise taxes, mainly for wealthy people, and we're using that money to pay for services that people really need and will continue to need. And I think most Minnesotans really are okay with that because it's a quality of life issue. One, I heard one story here, she moved to Minnesota when she needed, of course you have a daughter here, right? But, you know, if it was a place where you couldn't get care for your husband, you wouldn't come here either. And so quality of life is really, really important to us as Minnesotans. And as tough as it is to ask Minnesotans to pay for that quality, I think it's really important that we do that. We have to, everybody has to understand we're all in this together. And let's keep moving forward. I hope now with the budget surplus, so-called, having grown to $1.86 billion, I hope that we will put a significant portion of that toward the needs that the state still has. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Representative Daniels. Thank you, Chair Schumacher, for bringing us on the road. I think sometimes we get so focused on St. Paul. Just keep in mind that all of you folks can contact us. So each of you have relationships with different members in the legislature, and you can send emails and phone calls or knock on our doors when we're home on the weekends or at night, whatever that may be, and I challenge you to do that and tell these stories to each of the members that you can touch in your own way. Sometimes we get so much of a lobbying focus at the Capitol and a little less from our friends and our neighbors, so thank you for that. And that's really essentially how I think Representative Liebling really captured much of it. But thank you for bringing us on the road, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to wrap it up, but I just have to say thank you to the Faribault Senior Living and its residents for allowing us to hold a committee meeting here. Thank you for that. Thank you for Calista Moss for setting this up and getting everything organized for today. Thank you for all my members that were able to make it today. Thank you for the department staff for coming down and visiting my hometown. All the testifiers, thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate the passion, and we will hopefully get us on the right direction here coming this next few years and get us on a track that will take care of our seniors. And that does it. Thank you for coming. And we are adjourned.